Welcome back to the Reverse Autoimmune Disease Summit, everybody. I'm Dr. Keisha Ewers, and I'm so happy to bring back one of my lovely friends and colleagues who is really a passionate advocate for helping kids get comfortable in the kitchen, cooking good, healthy brain food. So in this particular iteration of the Reverse Autoimmune Disease Summit, we're talking about the autoimmune brain. And I'm just so happy to introduce you to Katie Kimball, who is the founder and CEO of Kitchen Stewardship. She's passionate about researching natural remedies and making healthy cooking easier for busy families. And over the last 11 years, she's become a trusted authority and advocate for children's health. Welcome to the summit, Katie.
Thank you, Dr. Keisha. It's so good to be here.
So I usually ask people, you know, like, how did you get to where you are today? And because we all have a story. And I know in the autoimmune thread of the story, you've got some of this in your family, right?
I do. Yeah. I think one of my strongest memories was, so my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, was diagnosed with Crohn's disease as a freshman in college. And when we were seniors, I did this like really fun night for his birthday. I had this poster board with these like top 10 of Chris's favorites, like his favorite song, his favorite meal, his favorite movie. Like we just kind of did all of them in that night. And his favorite meal was lasagna, you know, like gluten and dairy extravaganza. So I made homemade lasagna and he was just on the couch. He was like in so much pain. Yeah. And he says it was like the most painful night he ever remembers, and he can still picture it. We kind of had to cut it short, and I was driving him back to campus, and he's leaning back in the front seat of my minivan, because I was a really cool college student with the minivan. And he can still picture like turning this one corner back to Michigan State's campus and just being in agony. We ended up finishing that senior year with him. They almost didn't let him graduate. 2 days after college graduation, he had 12 inches of intestine removed. He was, you know, liquid diet instead of going out for a steak after graduating college.
Yeah. So this is of course, a big one for people with Crohn's disease, right? Is this kind of experience that lets them know that their body is not in harmony with whatever they're eating and whatever their thoughts they are, the thinking, the stress, right?
Yeah. And we didn't know at the time, we had no clue at the time that food was involved. I mean, he was 100%, you know, conventional medicine. He had prednisone, he had all sorts of drugs. And I remember the surgeon after the surgery said, "All right, well, buddy, we're done here. I'll see you back in about 7 years."
Yeah.
That's the average return time. And that, honestly, I think it was that line that most got under my skin. And I thought, man, there's gotta be something better than just hacking out a chunk every 7 years. Like that doesn't seem sustainable.
Do the math, right? Yeah.
Yeah. You're going to run out.
That's actually in my own story of being diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. That was kind of the sort of statement from my doctor when she diagnosed me was, "Here are two prescriptions. When you get worse, come back." Not if, right? Mm-hmm. There's something about that where you go, "Well, wait a second. You know, are you cementing my future in stone right now? You know, I don't understand that." And then, so that actually kind of, you know, an independent nature comes in handy right there, right? I'm going to go do my own research. I'm going to go.
You kind of see it as a challenge. Like, maybe not seven.
Yeah,
maybe 10 or 20 or never.
Right. So you became very passionate about food, and then you got your kids involved in the kitchen. How has that gone for you guys as a family and your story?
Yeah, I mean, with Crohn's being genetic, that's always been a huge concern. And it's been, you know, something that we prayed for from the time that they were newborns, like, oh, dear Lord, like, don't let the genetic component and the environmental component, and however that works, happen, you know, don't let that switch turn on, of that genetic switch. So I mean, from the moment my first was born, I worried with every poop, like, does he have a tendency toward Crohn's disease, you know? So it was incredibly important. And then by then I was starting just on the edge of my kind of real food journey. I was just starting to understand the power of food as fuel. I wasn't even there for food as medicine yet. It would be about five more years, really, before I understood food as medicine. But we knew, like, as soon as we did start understanding that, it was like, oh my gosh, the kids are the first priority, because if we can get their foundations right, maybe we can just prevent all of that pain and suffering and questions and doctor's appointments that my husband went through. And I know, I mean, I'm a teacher by trade. I'm not in medicine at all. I'm a teacher with an English degree, but I knew that kids being involved with their food would be the most powerful way to keep it sustainable, right? Like, I could feed them healthy food and I could set those habits, but if I sent them off to college at age 18 and they didn't know how to do it for themselves, either they'd be back at my house every night or every weekend, which, you know, maybe no, or they'd be doing the frozen pizza, ramen noodles, you know, like they would be doing whatever they could. And so I just knew I needed to lay those foundations with them.
Excuse me. It's really interesting because this third iteration of the Reverse Autoimmune Disease Summit, of course, is called the Autoimmune Brain. And people might be listening and going, now what do kids in the kitchen and Crohn's disease have to do with the autoimmune brain? And so I just want to draw a picture before we get into it, you know, of these three nervous systems in the body, of which one is the enteric nervous system, the second brain, which is the gut. And it's connected, you know, to the central nervous system. We have this wonderful vagus nerve that wanders. It's called the wandering nerve in Latin. One of our cranial nerves, and you know, it actually connects the brain to everything else. And then we have a cardiovascular nervous system too. So we have these three very important nervous systems, which are all connected. But when we're talking about a gastrointestinal disease, an autoimmune disease like Crohn's, I just wanted to show that connection between the brain, right, and the gut, because it is very real. And then how these genetics express themselves. So my rheumatoid arthritis, your husband's Crohn's, right? Your fear that your children are harboring genetics that could pop. That all, you know, one of the things that's so very true about all this is what happens in the brain or in the mind crystallizes in the body. And that's what Ayurvedic medicine says. I love that. What happens in your mind crystallizes in your body. And the way that they think about it, 10,000-year-old sister science of yoga from India, they identified all those years ago that actually autoimmunity is undigested anger and fear. So when we're afraid and we're worried, you know, it's actually kind of generating. And so more of that potential popping of our genetics. So putting your kids in the kitchen to empower them, right? Now you're taking the bathtub drain out and releasing the bathtub of fear, of anger, of, you know, all of those emotions that are actually just dysfunctional coping strategies to events you have no control over. So it's like, wow, yeah, why not put the kids in the kitchen, right? And you're teaching them tools that they'll have for the rest of their lives, which, as you noted, your husband and you in college, you know, not even understanding that this lasagna would have an impact on right. genetic expression, on gut, right? on how he felt. So you're ahead of the curve, and my kids are too. And I just think that's I think it's one of the most beautiful gifts. A lot of the people listening to the summit will have their own story of autoimmunity. And if you are listening and you're a grandparent or you're a parent, what Katie's sharing is, I believe, one of the most freeing, empowering things you can do and gifts you can give to your children and grandchildren. So I'm going to ask you, as you put your kids in the kitchen, right? Because I know I had my own obstacles with that with my kids along the way. As I started cleaning up my diet, they resisted a little bit. They weren't babies, right? And so we had started some habits like ramen noodles and,
shift.
Right, gluten. And it wasn't until my son, who actually has Asperger's syndrome, I didn't even realize the relationship between gluten and dairy and autism either until he was 12. So there were some obstacles in our family, and now they're really amazing. My oldest is the one that resists the most, but the others are just incredibly healthy eaters. So what is it that you find are obstacles as you work with people who are getting their kids into the kitchen, and your own story of putting your kids in the kitchen?
Yeah, it's mostly not the food. it's the parents. It's mostly our own kind of mental blocks, like, oh, the kids are too slow. I can just get it done myself. It's so messy. I don't want to deal with that. Some parents just feel a little inadequate. Like, I'm barely limping along in the kitchen myself. I have no clue where to start or how to explain it to kids. For me, it was definitely I can just get it done faster myself. But I hit a point where I was working so hard in the kitchen to feed my children, I was starting to forget what they looked like, because I wasn't, I just wasn't seeing them. I thought, I need help. I need, this needs to be a family affair here.
Sous chefs, that's what I call mine.
Exactly. I mean, I've had one meal a week completely off for the last 3 years. My 12 and 15 year old have cooked one meal for the last 3 years. So that's the dream when you think, it's all about and return on investment. Like, yes, you can do it faster yourself today, Katie, but if you can slow down a little bit today and teach them, you have these sous chefs for the rest of your days, and you're building skills with them. So I think, I do a lot of kind of mindset, motivation, rah, rah, cheering with my parents in our courses, because it's hard to commit, to getting the kids and the food and the plan all together. So that's what I try to do, is just kind of smooth the road. And I'll at least do the thinking for you. I can't send a dishes fairy, still working on the tech on that one, but really understanding that it's a long game and to think about those end goals.
My 26 year old daughter now, her name is Kendall Morris, and she's been a guest on one of the Reverse Autoimmune Disease Summit. She's a powerhouse, and she has a blog called Kendall's Kitchen, K-E-N-D-Y-L, Kendall's Kitchen. And she is the most marvelous, amazing cook. She's doing her own cookbook right now. And she has, teaching my children at a young age to feel powerful and free in the kitchen, not constrained, where they felt like they could experiment and not get shamed for it, and they could screw up, and it was just there's a difference between baking soda and baking powder for sure, and that's not going to happen again, I bet, and just really helping them to feel like they could experiment in there. I remember handing over when my daughter was Kendall, when she was 8, maybe 9, handing over the Thanksgiving pies to her. Wow. And teaching her how to do a paleo crust, which is tricky.
Oh, yeah.
And I haven't had to make a pie. I've done it because I wanted to, but I haven't had to make a pie for a holiday for all these years since, because she is a master, and it was just giving it to her. She felt so honored. Right? Like she had this place in the culinary culture of our family, and it was a powerful place. Like, I'm in charge of the pies, right?
Yeah.
And here's how to do it with no sugar. And here's how to make a crust that doesn't have gluten in it, with almond flour, and all these different, tools that I taught her at such a young age. And she came by today. I was out in the sauna and I didn't really get to see her, and she left me a little note, and on a little plate, she had one of Danielle Walker's Against All Grain chocolate donuts sitting on the plate with a little flower and a note that told me that she loved me. I was like, oh my gosh, this is the return on the investment, right?
Yes. Well, in that story, I think that story is perfect for when we're talking about the brain and mental health, because again, I went into this super practical, they need life skills and I need help, and this is why I'm teaching my kids to cook. But now that, working with thousands of families and hearing their stories, mm-hmm. now at Kids Cook Real Food, we say that we build connection, confidence, and creativity.
Yeah.
And so that connection, like you talked about with your family history kind of, and your connection with your food, your connections in families, that is incredibly mentally health supportive, right? Feeling mm-hmm. connected. I think we've seen this with the pandemic and shelter in place, how when disconnected is very dangerous. And then the confidence, oh my gracious, the confidence that kids build in the kitchen, not only gives them confidence with cooking, but I really think it spills out into other areas of life. I know my daughter Leah, last year as a fifth grader, applied to be a class officer, and she's really reserved. I was like, this is very strange. But her little speech talked about cooking for her family and watching her brothers, and just that, that was genuine self-esteem that's allowing her to feel like a more powerful human being, not just a more empowered cook. And creativity, you know, the idea of working with your hands and that just like cathartic, repetitive motions of chopping and stirring and maybe kneading bread dough, not really paleo bread dough, but for people who can do gluten, all of those creative with your hands motions are really stress relieving, and just being artistic and, you know, throwing in different herbs and spices. Like, these are all wonderful for our kids' mental health.
All four of my adult children now, they range from 23 to 30, are 32 actually, are very creative in the kitchen. And they love to plate things in a beautiful way. It's a presentation. They love to, you know, create a meal plan for the family that, you know, when we get together. And it's just so beautiful to move into the kitchen. Last Christmas, we did a tapas thing where we did boards. It was all boards. And we did these gorgeous boards. I had an idea. I presented it to them and they took off. Aww. You know, and that's this family creativity culture of sharing and then dancing and singing and, you know, all the things that happen in between the measuring, right? And it's just this beautiful connectivity. I love the three words that you chose that cooking allows for when you're all in the kitchen together. And like you said earlier, when you're willing to let go of your own expectations, you know, your time constraints, your messiness, your, you know, all of those things, because it's the outcomes are so, so beautiful. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk a little bit about vegetables, because so far, you know, we've been talking a little bit about baking, but let's talk about vegetables. I hear this a lot from my patients. How do I get my kids to like vegetables? And you probably hear that all the time.
Oh yeah. All the time. I mean, there's super cool science behind why getting them in the kitchen will help them eat more vegetables. And I mean, like, first of all, it just happens. Like we see kids all the time. I mean, I'm just hearing stories this week. People are saying, I have tried to get my kids to eat ants on a log before, and they just did the spreading class. They spread their nut butter on their celery and they ate it. And I was like, what up? Like, I guess it was worth, you know, it was worth the time putting in. So we see it all the time, but the kind of cool science behind that is, first of all, there's so much less pressure to eat in the kitchen than at the table. So for picky eaters who might've experienced power struggles and every time a plate is put in front of them, they kind of feel like, oh no, I'm going to have to eat this. So that's step one, is there's no pressure to eat.
Plus they don't have control over what winds up on the dining room table. If they're in the kitchen, it's like they have a voice, right?
Yes. My kids love that they can.
So then it's not a power struggle.
Mm-hmm. They can make more of their own choices. And even if they're working with food that they don't even think they like there's an exposure element where they're kind of getting acclimated with that food. They're making friends with that food, but they know they don't have to eat it. So it's okay. There's no pressure. But I know Dr. Nicole Birkins, who I'm sure you're familiar with, kind of taught me about this, what I call the exposure bucket. Like, every person with every food has a certain number of times they need to be exposed to it before they'll eat it. And your pickiest eaters, their bucket might be very deep. You know, it might be 231 times they have to like encounter that broccoli. That'd be a lot of times to put a piece of broccoli on a child's plate. So it's awesome to know that when they shop for the food, wash the food, cut the food, serve the food, it all adds up.
I haven't encountered lima beans enough, apparently, because I'm never eating them.
I'm sure we all have a couple foods, but overall, yep. It takes time. Maybe you haven't encountered that enough.
Maybe I haven't cooked well, right? I haven't encountered them cooked well as a child, so and enough so that as an adult, I now have the control, and I never has a lima bean been put on a plate in this household. And we were just talking about that the other day. My adult daughter loves lima beans. I said, how'd you ever get exposed to those? Because it didn't come from me. She goes, I know, Mom. I was so surprised. Like, what is this new food?
That's funny. No, that's funny. I know. So maybe you do, you know, challenge your kids to like bring lima beans.
Right. Exactly.
Eventually, you know, I mean, like, think about adults, like the first time most of us tried coffee. Many adults don't like coffee, but we like acquire that taste, right? So it's a kind of a similar process with like acclimating the palate, and even just smelling the foods can be part of that exposure and that acclimation. So it really does help. And then also mentally, psychologically, people don't like open loops. And so when you're part of starting something, there's a little part in your brain that tells you you should finish it. And that's pretty powerful for kids. Like when they feel invested, now they do kind of want to finish that process at the table and taste the food. So it's really powerful.
Which is why also, if you can get them into the growing process, it's even more powerful, right? I started with just kitchen herbs with that. Just growing them in little, in those days, sorry, everybody, it was styrofoam cups, but you know, I didn't know what I didn't know yet.
You can only do what you know, yes.
Right. The little styrofoam cups they brought home from elementary school. And I remember thinking, oh, that's a good idea. Let's do some more things like that, right? And then, oh, so how do we use these? And then inviting them into the kitchen to show them how to use these kitchen herbs. And then they wanted the food because they had grown it, right? And then we moved to vegetables. Yeah.
And it always tastes better fresh. That was, I mean, my third child, John, he's 8 now, but he was like between the ages of 2 and 5, he was the no green foods kid. And I was like, who is this? Like, I've been feeding him all the good things. And then all of a sudden he got a voice and became a little person. Cause that's kind of what happens at age 2. They kind of come into their own ego. Right. And he would not touch anything green, but we visited a friend's garden. All of a sudden I look over and he is chowing green beans straight raw off the vine. And so I learned that he will, and he still is like, about cooked green beans, but then he would not eat cooked green beans, but he would eat them frozen out of the bag from Costco. So whenever I'd make green beans, I'd like clink, clink, clink a little, like a couple of frozen ones on his plate, and here it's like a popsicle. You just never know.
That's called adaptability. It's a really good feature to have as a parent.
you gotta try all the ways of cooking and raw and dips and on your head and in the garden.
Being adaptable, right. Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that you say is cooking is so much more than just kitchen work. So how do you think learning to cook impacts kids in other ways other than what we've spoken about?
Yeah, you know, we have had such a push in the last few decades in our culture, I think, to build up kids' self-esteem. And it breaks my heart that it's not working. Like statistically, 1/3 of our teens are depressed and anxious, and suicide's the second leading cause of death for people aged 10 to 24. Like, it's not working. Saying good job and participation medals and trophies, it falls flat because they're empty platitudes, right? And I just think that to show kids that they can do something so authentic and so necessary as nourishing another human being, you don't even have to say any words, right? When kids watch other adults eat the food that they just made, it's like self-esteem raining down on them. And again, that comes back to obviously mental health as well. And they, you know, the brain and the mental health, but then, you know, obviously the foods that we're eating.
You know, this is an interesting point you're bringing up, Katie, that goes outside of self-esteem so far. There's a book called, The Narcissism Epidemic. Ooh. And it's done by a couple of researchers from different universities who came together and did a study. And what they found is that narcissistic personality disorder, which has a DSM-5, you know, criteria for diagnosis and everything, was on the rise. But also narcissism outside of narcissistic personality disorder was on the rise. And they pointed to 4 different reasons that was happening. And this, of course, is linked to what you just noted, that the Princeton researchers have started calling death of despair, which is suicide, but it's also addiction to substances and also alcoholic liver disease, cirrhosis, as well as fatty liver. So this is really an important topic that I don't want to just have thrown out and go over the top of. What you just said is so vital for us to understand about the way that our, you know, our culture has been moving. And one of the 4 things that they said for reasons why narcissism was on the rise from the 1960s to where we are today is the self-esteem curriculum in the school system. That everybody gets a trophy, everybody gets patted on the head and told good job, actually doesn't create an environment where our kids come out of the school system feeling, like we said at the very beginning of this interview, powerful and empowered. And in fact, when they get out into the world and someone else in their job world is not doing that for them, like just telling them they're great doing nothing, they get really upset, right?
Because I can't believe that didn't work out.
Wait a second, I'm supposed to work for that, you know? And so, you know, that was one of the four. The second one of the four reasons narcissism on the rise, and I'm coming out of memory here, I might not be able to remember all four of them, is social media. FOMO, right? Really fear of missing out and seeing that everybody else is living a life of your dreams and you're not, right? Third one was the desire to be famous, like YouTube star overnight, right?
It feels like everybody can be famous all the time.
Yes.
Without any
and then if you're not, that you're failing. Mm. Like being famous and noted on that level is the ground of being for living instead of just being is, you know, you're worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth reason, I am remembering them all, it was easy access to loans so that you could actually buy whatever you wanted and live as extravagantly as you wanted to. Huh. And it was like this empty bubble and shell. And that the kids that came out of all of that are really, really struggling with these deaths of despair now. And so, you know, it kind of harkens back to what we were just saying where, you know, I said when I handed my daughter the role of Thanksgiving pies, she took a place in the culinary culture of our family, right? That actually, what you've just pointed to is vital, you know, giving them something where they are a participant and it's not about self-esteem, it's about self-worth, mm-hmm. right? I'm worth having a place, I can take up space in this family unit. Here's my role, right? And actually carving a space for them and saying, you belong here and look what you provide. And there's nothing like cooking to really do that for children. So I just love that you brought that up and I can't even believe how important it is.
Oh, that's so good. I love that research. I never use the word narcissism. I often use the word entitlement. Coming from more of kind of the sociology perspective. I know the mm-hmm. author, Julie Lythgott-Hames of How to Raise an Adult, fascinating. Mm-hmm. She was a college dean at Stanford, I think, and mm-hmm. over 10 years watched college freshmen come in and noticed a severe decline in independence. Like parents would actually be answering questions for their kids in intake interviews.
The helicopter.
Yeah. So she sort of researched like the helicopter parenting and all the different ways that kids are coming out of their like childhood feeling so entitled. And I feel like the loans are like, you know, one piece of that, but also if those researchers had looked at parenting, I never want my kids to feel entitled, which is why I give them chores. Cause then I have less opportunity to give them a gift. You know, they're packing their own lunches and they're cleaning dishes after dinner. Anytime I say, hey, you know, I noticed you're really busy today. I packed your lunch for you. Mm. They feel genuine gratitude, which
it's
is like
an act of generosity instead of an expectation.
Yes, polar opposite of expectation and entitlement. Yeah. So I think that just really builds a very nice family structure where it's not like I never do anything for them, but when I do, it's appreciated. You know, not that I need appreciation, but it's good for people to feel gratitude towards others.
Right. And you do need appreciation. I mean, you know, it's important, right? I think it's a good muscle to build in your children is appreciation. There's this interesting, I'm going to take us off into another little tangent. You keep dropping these words and I go, oh yeah, that's so cool. And the other one is entitlement, you know, and I'm writing a book on healing trauma and I have a chapter in there about entitlement. And oftentimes people think of entitlement in the way you and I have been talking about it, you know, college freshmen arriving in and just sort of like, or arriving into a workplace environment and expecting something for nothing. But I do believe that every single human, and I like to teach my patients with autoimmunity this concept early on. So I'm loving the opportunity to talk about this. Every human is entitled. And if you take it into a broader sense of it and just sort of like remember this morning when you woke up and when you opened your eyes, you actually expected them to work and function the way that they were when you closed them the night before. And then you expected your body heart to still be beating, and you expected to be able to brush your teeth, and you expected to be able to move around in the world in whatever way you expect. And yeah. all of that's entitlement. And I always think about that, like, nobody ever promised us a body that works, right? Just because you're born into a body doesn't mean that it's going to work in a certain way. And people that have autoimmune disease will often feel very betrayed by their bodies. And so the shift that I try to make, like, this is the autoimmune mindset change, right? Mm-hmm. Is to help them go, oh, my body's not betraying me and it's not failing me. It's actually showing up for me in this really passionate way where it's saying, hey, something's not working here. And I really want to talk to you about this, right? Mm-hmm. And instead we have this entitled way of being with it. Like, no, you're supposed to do this, right? And you don't have enough energy and you're not doing, and so I'm going to drink this coffee. And it's like, this body, I think, has the most thankless job of anything on the planet, because it never gets to rest. We go to sleep and the heart still works, the liver still dumps, the lymphatic system still cleans everything up, right? And then we wake up expecting it. We feel entitled to have this body that will just get us out of bed in the morning. And actually, that is not... that's not a realistic expectation. There's nowhere in any fine print or contract that says that that's supposed to happen for us. It's kind of like when someone, and I know this is a terrible one to use as an example, but when someone loses a child, you know, and you say, no one's ever supposed to bury a child. And, you know, my thought on that is, well, who said that? Like, that's not true, right? And so if we have an expectation and we feel entitled to life being a certain way, we're going to be disappointed and upset and feel betrayed. But if we can understand that and then drop into this incredible, like what you're just saying, deep appreciation, like, oh, my kids are alive. My body works to the level that it works. And I get to engage in this amazing life with the people that I love and with these cultural, even these cultural transformational issues happening today. Like, I'm alive to do this. Mm. Then we approach it in such a different way, and that changes the biochemistry of the brain. It's no longer an autoimmune brain, because now you're feeling gracious appreciation. Wow. Right?
That is a powerful shift. I needed that. I'm glad that we wandered our way into that little bit.
It is really interesting, this beautiful, beautiful body. And then we want to feed it the way that you've been talking about, right? It's like, oh, body, let me give you these wonderful vegetables, right? Instead of let me shove sugar into you, or, you know, and make you do something different than what you're doing right now, because I want to control it and I'm upset with you, right? It's just a different way. So I just so appreciate you bringing up the idea of entitlement and the way that this conversation has gone. And my dogs have something to say about this too.
He has opinions. No.
So what I'm going to do is you have a free gift for our listeners to help get your guys' kids and grandkids in the kitchen. Katie is the marvelous, passionate educator on this. So I'm going to have a link for that. And I want you to talk about your free gift, Katie.
Yeah, every time we ask our members, what's your favorite skill that we teach? It's always the knife skills. So our 10-minute knife skills and safety lesson, and that's for kids of all ages. One of my missions is to raise the bar. So we talk about using the same skills with butter knives as we do with chef's knives. It's not about, you know, kid techniques. No, like, let's just learn to cut things. And when we talk about fruits and vegetables, right, like, knife techniques are the way to unlock that produce section. So I think it's so important to build those skills in kids. And just after this one class, you may have some sous chefs on your hands.
Oh, that's beautiful. Because if they get to chop that tomato with that knife and they've been trusted with it, and you're not running to the ER, it's a win-win.
All right. Fingers accounted for.
It's a win-win. All right. Well, thank you so much for the work you do in the world, Katie. I so appreciate you.
Oh, it's nice to connect with you and the audience here too. Thank you.
All right, everybody, until next time, be well.